Let's move to the next presentation. It's going to be a presentation by Paul Weaver and David Honor about distributed control of applications. And let's get right to it.
Hello.
Oh, that's loud. Thanks for coming. It's been really interesting being here the last few days. We were here at LAC for the first time last year, and there was lots of interesting things, and so we thought we should sort of introduce ourselves and share what we've been kind of working on over the last sort of year or so, which is a thing called CLAPI, the Concert Lightweight API Framework, which is all about sort of distributed control of stuff. The lightweight is in scare quotes because we started wanting to make something really light and breezy and just a sort of extra layer on top of OSC, and it got more involved. So what I want to talk about today is kind of who we are, where we've come from, why we're building an API framework in the first place, and what CLAPI ended up being, and kind of what you can do with it. And hopefully at the end we'll have a bit of an interactive demo so that we can show like what we're kind of aiming towards.
By interactive, we mean you.
So we started this thing, we had to give it a name because we were talking to people about it quite a lot, called Concert, which came out of the idea that Dave and I are both Python developers, mainly is what we've done in the past together, and we really like working with each other online. So we're used to development workflow with Git and version control, seeing what everyone's doing and commenting on threads and things. And we are used to collaborating on code together on a single session. So I'll fire up a tmux session where Dave can come and connect, and we can like comment on code and make changes and suggest things in a really sort of fluid way. And we didn't come across anything like this for audio. And we were sort of toying around with the idea of, why can't audio be version controlled in Git? Why can't we manage to find things where we can collaborate on sessions remotely? So we're trying to build a collaborative kind of collaborative audio production tools with a kind of soft real-time interactive element and a sort of asynchronous workflow management as well, that's all part of the same kind of data model. That's the grand lofty goal. This kind of sketch is the bit that we're talking about today, which is a lot less grand sounding. Basically, we're going to have some kind of API provider that is doing some audio processing and presenting an API. And we've got some devices that effectively the goal is that they could be anything. So it's kind of a heterogeneous mix of stuff that can connect. And the bits we've been working on are really these communication channels, the lines between these components, and the bit in the middle that's sort of the hub where everyone connects to, and kind of the architecture of that. Was there anything else more on this one that we want to talk about? Cool. Just to give you a bit of idea about the languages we've been writing, the audio processing in the provider is written in C, and then we've ended up in Haskell, so some of the application layer of that is written in Haskell. The relay is exclusively in Haskell, and then the UIs we're looking at are going to be written in sort of JavaScript that's come from Elm, so there's a mixture of languages going on here. Quite a lot of stuff we've experimented with. Dave's just choking to death. Right. Okay, so we had a long list of requirements for stuff as we were thinking about our API. Event-driven was obviously a big requirement. We wanted to be able to push out things that were happening as they were happening, rather than having to do sort of big, chunky data updates with request-response. And because we've got a heterogeneous mix of clients where your phone might have play pause buttons on it, but your 4K display might have an entire door application on it, we want to be able to do subscriptions so that the phone doesn't get every single thing that's going on in the whole ecosystem because it doesn't need them, it'll throw them all away, whereas the desktop needs to be able to update with everything. Validation, introspection, and dynamic schema all kind of come as one lump. We want to be able to check that the messages that clients and providers are sending are legitimate, so they are what they should be, and that there's some kind of way of knowing in advance what the messages over the protocol are going to be. That will come in a lot later when we have a look at the user interface, but like most of our user interface can just be generated by introspecting the API schema rather than having to code a static user interface. the idea of this being that, as Mark was really explaining really nicely yesterday in his talk about RTOSC, you're keeping your data with the thing that is actually talking about it and generating it, and everything else is sort of subservient to that idea. And we need dynamic schema because we're hoping to be able to host plugins that will be able to provide what their data types are, and we want the to be able to find all of that stuff out as we go dynamically, rather than having to again communicate bits of UI and things and keep them all in sync.
Effectively, that's a case of we don't know our schema up front. We can't just produce like a soap-style WSDL that contains all the things a plugin might ever do. That's just not viable, so we have to take a slightly different approach.
Yes. Other things to do with sort of our collaboration model. We are in a domain where we want to talk about time series data. We've kind of got our project time space as well as what people are doing right now in the real world and mapping those two together. And we kind of wanted, as we were exploring the APIs, we were trying to think of a way of talking about these as sort of first-class citizens in our data model. We want to track attribution of everything, which is something that we hadn't really come across in many APIs at all. You've got this collection of clients all talking, but they're different people, potentially. And so we want to know who changed what when, because if you're in an environment where people are doing things underneath you, hey, Dave, stop fiddling with that EQ that I was fiddling with, that, you know, kind of thing, problem. We will get onto a bit about caching, and we want to be able, because we've got all the schemas and the introspection and everything, we want to be able to make sure that we're consistent, so we never get to a state where, you know, we don't quite know what's going on or we're half updated. So that's quite a long list of high-level constraints. And this sounds like a shopping list that we went in with, but really we found it really hard to write this talk because we only discovered some of these when we're halfway through, and go, of course, I just need to know who clicked on this button, and the person who did it is like miles away from what we're doing. So we definitely started off by looking at other things that existed. So we both work in a domain where we're doing things with lots of APIs in our day jobs. We were, and we deal with network protocols a lot. So OSC is the canonical kind of audio API that everyone, or audio API kind of framework that everyone's been talking about over this weekend, and it's really good. It's event driven and it's really simple to understand, and that was great for us. The downside that we saw was that it was sort of unidirectional and specifically really oriented to UDP, and we've got very session oriented connections going on. So we'll come onto some of that in a minute. HTTP is fab from my point of view. I've done loads of HTTP API work. We've done XML RPC, we've done things with SOAP, we've done things with REST and all kinds of frameworks there. And there's a rich set of established semantics over that and content negotiation, all sorts of things. And the web generally is actually very well designed in that way. But it's very request response heavy. You've got definite server, definite client, and stuff doesn't really just happen. And everything that comes on top of that, like dynamic in web pages, is all kind of an additional layer or two of things going on.
Yeah, so if you define something with WebSockets, which would be a way to get away from the request response, you're basically defining yourself another protocol anyway. It doesn't really buy you as much as it would if you were speaking standard request response HTTP.
And then for some of the responsive systems we developed when we were working at Cisco, we had subscription models in AMQP, for example, but then those that broker kind of pub-sub thing is just about method dispatch and getting your data to where it wants to go, and you can't inject into the broker anything about like what the content of the message is, because they're designed to be very big scales worth of data and just very fast dispatch, so they don't blend well to that. So we had a naive plan. We were going to start with OSC in PyLibLO, because we're writing Python, to rapidly prototype some stuff. We just pick some features from the other paradigms that we liked and kind of have some lightweight conventions that we put on top of OSC, and it would all be great.
And that was horrendous. We had some of the things that are really good in normal OSC turn out to be really problematic for us. So for instance, the bundle semantics. In OSC, they're about all these things happen simultaneously. For us, we have an idea of like an atomic commit across paths in the tree. If you try and abuse the OSC one for that, you run into all sorts of weird edge cases, because you can send stuff not in a bundle. The bundle has a time that doesn't really mean anything. You can nest the bundles, and what does that mean for your transactions? And it all gets very gnarly in a way that's totally understandable because we're trying to abuse it. we also found we needed some extra bits. Like, we had some functions that didn't take, like, their parameters weren't ints. They took a list of ints as a parameter. And that's something that isn't in the standard OSC, so you have to add a convention for that. And we needed, as we said before, we're talking about these time series. How do you do that? Well, you could sort of put it in the path, but then you're putting like an NTP timestamp in the path, and that's kind of horrible. Or you put it as a first argument, and then it doesn't really work very well like that either. So that all got very tricky, and we also were trying to do something kind of restful in the sense that our paths represented a particular piece of data rather than a method call. And so that was also a little tricky. So we ended up defining, when we were in OSC, another layer on top of OSC that translated what we had. It kind of serialized what
serialized
we meant
to
OSC, into
OSC,
which we then serialized. So when we switched to Haskell and there wasn't an established OSC library for it, we sort of thought it would be easier to not get involved in the translating to translate. We have kept a lot of the flavor of OSC in our serialization format, but the serialization format of many things is not really the tricky bit.
Yep.
At least for us as protocols people, it seemed like writing a parser was not too horrendous.
So we switched to Haskell because when we were prototyping in Python, there were a lot of complicated ideas that all end on each other, and testing it and keeping it up to date as we were changing our ideas for everything was really hard. And Haskell, I have found to be quite good. Someone lent me a book. I've only been developing Haskell for about 2 years, but someone lent me a book and said, you'll probably like this and the way you think. And yeah, it basically now tells me wherever I've made a mistake, and I like that because I can't track things in my head. I'm very forgetful. So what finally we get to what Clappy is. We've basically built a TCP-based sort of session-oriented protocol, and with a broker in the middle, which was that relay thing we looked at. It's trying to represent, as Dave said, a tree of typed data, so as resources that you can subscribe to as they change over time. And we can always verify the types of those. We have an in-memory cache, so unlike something like AMQP, where you can subscribe to a channel, but you only get messages that occurred after you subscribed, we will know what the last state of every resource was, so that when you subscribe, you get told what the current state is, and then you get all the updates as they come. We validate all the messages in atomically applied blocks, so we have things like cross-references in our API. So if you cross-reference a path that's gone away in your collection of messages, it'll say, well, hang on a minute, like that's not valid anymore, you need to sort it out. So it's a little bit databasey we got into in some senses, yeah. And that was bad. And then, yeah, we have these two roles. So the things I drew on the left before, which were the providers, they have a different set of things they can say to the clients. But a single connection, as when you're connected on a single connection, you can act as both roles. You can only say certain things about certain things. The API providers, they occupy like a top-level namespace within the tree. So we have a couple in the example we're going to show you today. We have like the API that tells you about the API, sort of meta API. We have the relay, which is the API for the actual broker component itself. And we have the engine, which is sort of our the audio engine that's actually doing the processing's API. And each provider will publish a collection of types that says, here are all the things I can talk about. And it will say, here's the data that conforms to all the things I can talk about. And crucially, when it's publishing data, it just publishes on the one stream and says, that happened, go figure. And it doesn't matter if no one's connected or if like 20 people are connected, they all just get the same broadcast. And they just receive updates as a single sort of serialized stream of requests. So they're not having to juggle whoever might be connected, which is especially important because we're trying to keep the network overhead on the audio processing component, like or the machine doing the audio processing, really low. The API clients have a simpler job. They subscribe to the types and the data, and they get pushed updates for the things they're interested in, and then they can flip that around and say, oh, change that value to 3 or whatever. So this is kind of pseudocode for what our API represents. This is the sort of simplest API that we provide in our relay. So at the top, I will use my mouse because that will be easier. At the top, this this type here, this is type land in the top pane. We say that the API namespace is a structure that has one member that is called version. It's of this type, API's namespace and the version type, and it's read-only. So then we can look at what the version type is, and we just see that it's a pair of unsigned 32-bit integers. Okay, fair enough. And then in the sort of value space, as opposed to the type space, we just say that the path slash API slash version has this pair of values 0, 0, and 1. Then we can move on to something a little bit more sort of fully fledged and rich. This is the API that we're going to demo the UI for in a minute.
There's
more stuff. We'll break it down because it is a little bit sort of overbearing when you first look at it. So the engine namespace, the namespace for the provider who's going to do the audio processing for us, has, amongst other things, a transport member which has this type, and you're not allowed to change the contents of the container. So we've got a lot of stuff around containers, and just sort of flipping through this, basically information about editability and read-onlyness, we can get down to the three data members that we care about. The sort of state of the transport, which has kind of got this rich type. I'm an enumeration of stopped and rolling. And a couple of things which do with time, so the cue point and the time at which we last changed play state. And here you can see the transport state in this current example is in 0, so we know the transport is stopped, and we can pull out those semantics and put it in the UI. And then we know where the cue point is, and we know when everything was last changed. So that's it. I'm probably going to skip time series data. We can come back to that if people are interested. And now it's time for some demo.
Yes. OK. So the demo, we actually explain what's going on here. The thing we drew up earlier, where we had all the API providers and bits and bobs, the majority of the components are currently running on this laptop. So we've got the audio engine, which is currently set to change a gain of nothing to nothing, because we're talking about semantics and not anything else, so we haven't bothered saying anything very fancy. That is connecting out through all the components we described. So there's a relay running here, and then there's for some UI. Yeah, here we go.
I'm going to turn around. We want to, in a minute, hang on, I'm just trying to. So the network here is a bit strange. I think it's partitioned. So if you've got a 172 address here, you should be able to connect to the UI.
Yes.
I'm going to open up another terminal. I haven't got enough space on this screen, and I can't see where my mouse has gone.
Right.
There we go. Found it.
Found it.
Cool.
So what will eventually appear once we've managed to get it to play nicely on the connecting.
There we go.
That's more like it. This is the super, super, super simple
prototypical
UI. So this is ugly. Things move around underneath you. But it's a piece of HTML that's connecting via a WebSocket, because, yes, we did have to do WebSockets in the end. We've got a bridge that talks JSON WebSockets to this thing, but it's just a translation. So this is our lump of elm, and if you were to, you can't see my thing, but so I can move stuff around on this and it'll move around on there.
Yeah, so Dave has a copy of this UI on his screen, and he's just moved the cue point for me. If I open up a new window in Firefox and I go to the same address, we'll see that I get a copy of the UI. And you can see that here, so the red and green highlighting are when things change. What's happened there, Dave?
Something unhappy has happened
has happened there, Dave.
Good old demo effect.
It is the demo effect. We checked this an hour ago, and it was working.
All right, so if you refresh it now, it'll be fine.
Ah, good, OK. There we go.
So that's to do with I started trying to add extra stuff to one of the components, and I seem to have broken it in some way.
So the thing we've got here is that we've got independent user interfaces. So the one on the bottom, I've just changed the zoom in, and that's local to the web browser, but the cue point is moving in all of them, and I can see brilliantly that you're all clicking things, and we're seeing things change. So at the bottom, this stuff is sort of debug diagnostic data, where we could just see who's connected. So,
And you can show the time difference between the clocks of the people who are connected and the relay. So at the moment, it's showing us in this one. What have you got there? You haven't got enough height.
Okay. I can you give you more out height. More height.
More height. You've got open... The relay is highlighted up there, and so is some random thing that's been clicked
on. This is a person.
This is some person. So you can tell that you are 81... Your clock is 81 seconds out with that of the relay. This all seems really weird.
Yeah.
Until... and probably so did the thing about us giving you the time when the last transport change happened. This all ties together because what you get when you start rolling is we can get the playhead state and where it's moving without having to send any update messages to you about where that is. For the purposes of the UI, anyway. Okay. Fun. Ah, transport SQL rolling not implemented. Yeah, thanks for that.
This is what happens when we touch our... everyone is sort of touching our everything. But you get the flavor. So we were showing there that we were seeing subscriptions to people's clock offsets, but only when I was interested in knowing what my clock offset was. So the green and the red were like new bits of data coming into the API and going away. We had the cue point moving with everybody. We had the transport state rolling with everyone, etc. Oh, okay. Wait. There we go.
So... Yes, not implemented features will get
anyway,
right now.
So that's our demo. Just very quickly in conclusion, if I can find the right page. My laptop doesn't like the screen. There we go. So we found that whilst we knew API design was hard, API meta design was really, really hard. Refactoring in Python, even though we both really were comfortable with Python and really liked it, became a burden as our code base got really complicated. We achieved our long list of requirements, which I realized when I was writing them down that I was quite pleased that I managed to do that. And that Introspection is actually really powerful because most of that UI is completely dynamically generated.
The UI that you see there is one that if there's a switcheroo button at the top, which you can press, which will let you just put paths in. And it doesn't know any more than this is the path I'm trying to show you. That's all it knows. So everything else is just generated.
Cool. So we got some more stuff we want to add. And you can find all the code on github.com/concert. And we're sort of concert.co.uk if you want to find out about us. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Hi, thank you for the presentation. And the concert is really meant for live performances. Like you have a shared transport, and you couldn't do like independent editing. Like you're in one room listening to one with one transport, and you're in another room.
This bit of it is for that. Eventually, we want to within a given. Situation, yeah, it's for the bit we're showing today is for I've got my phone and my computer, I'm going into the studio bit and I don't want to keep bothering the guy in the control room with this. Eventually we want to use one set of this whole thing as a client to another to allow partial synchronization as desired. But that is not there at all.
So far it's basically mostly remote control of...
Yes. Yes.
And the API is serializable to a form where you can git diff it. So if you've taken a snapshot of the API and another snapshot of the API, the one of the constraints is that you can then merge them, and only merge conflicts are like decisions you have to make.
Hi, good stuff. I have two questions for you.
Yes.
First one is, part of what you did very looks like protobuf or Thrith. Any reason why you didn't use those existing technologies?
We looked briefly, I've looked at protobuf before. Mostly, the prototype is still kind of a prototype, as you can tell, it's written in Haskell, is the serialization isn't our main problem. It's working out what each member is allowed to say and how they're allowed to say it. So, for example, the time series that I was going to put up, we have to uniquely identify each time point with an identifier so that if one person comes in and moves a time point in time and someone else wants to change the value, you know exactly what edits people are trying to make. So it's that kind of semantic level thing we're doing. And basically, as Dave said, when we were serializing our stuff to OSC, you could put OSC, you could put protobuf, you could probably put any kind of serialization format underneath you like. So absolutely, you know, we've done it. We the website that we were looking at was talking in JSON, because it was easier to get JSON across a WebSocket than it was to get binary.
And the second one, why did you find refactoring in Python complicated, and why is Haskell better?
I think it was mostly because the particular domain we're in here was extremely type-centric. So a lot of the things we're describing are...
The data types tend to flow through your code. So if you make a small change to something fundamental, everywhere you've used it, you have to change what you've done. And there's no way in Python you can see what you've used, because all of the things like Flake 8 or Pylint that look at your code have to cope with the fact that Python could have changed anything underneath you, so it can't make strong guarantees. In contrast, because Haskell follows everything through your code base, you can find things that are distant, and it will still say, you made a mistake here, it's not that thing. So it was mostly that.
I think, yeah, because I've been thinking about it while you were talking. It's because we have a lot of things that are, the data type defines what it is, not its behavior, in a sense. And I think if you had something where it was a lot about behaviors, then it would be a different balance, potentially.
Mm. Yeah. Hi. Thanks. Hello. A lot. It's maybe unrelated, but there is a lot of synchronization going on in this system. And I'm not a developer, like, in the proper sense of it, but I played with Tone.js and triggering audio synthesis from my machine to all the clients and all this. So I try to synchronize clients in a network to make more synchronized musical possible. But I only get to compile Ableton Link for Node.js. Someone made a port of it. Do you have any hints on that synchronization issue?
We're not really in the same... Whilst we have a thing that allows you to see where your transport is, it's only really UI-centric. It's not sending the broadcast. It's not doing the auto-discovery. So it's not the same at all as Ableton Link, really.
Yes, so our model is to try and remove as much synchronization requirement as possible, so that you get an impression of what someone's doing, but you don't know exactly when it is, because as soon as you go across the internet, really with our thing, you're not needing to get the audio exactly.
And at some point, we want to be able to do streams that are synced up to like wall clock time, but you're recording in sections of things. And when we hit that, there'll be a different... Our model is sort of different. We don't synchronize them explicitly. We stream to a buffer, and then we know when it was in session time for them, and we can realign it at any later point.
Okay, guys, I know there are still questions, but please approach Paul and David after the presentation, because we're out of time. So thank you, guys. Thanks for the presentation.
Thank you.
I forgot about that implemented back then.